While we were marching through Georgia, everybody swing your honey, swing your high and low. The Alaman left for the old left, and around the ring you go. A grand old right to left walk on your heel and toe. Promenade that pretty gal to Georgia.
I saw a movie the other day. It was on Tubi TV, with T-U-B-I. You can get that on your Roku or just get it online for free. The movie was called A Murder in Well, listen, on paper, it's Coweta, C-O-W-E-T-A. That's not how they say it. Let's hear how Johnny Cash says it.
I'm Sheriff Lamar Potts from over in Cayuga County.
Okay, A Murder in Cayuga County. It's a made-for-TV movie from 1982, and you know what? It's actually not bad. The best part about it are the actors. Johnny Cash as the good guy, he's the relentless county sheriff, and Andy Griffith as the evil moonshining murderer. If you've never seen it, I will reference the movie once in a while, but I'm basically going to treat the beginning of this as a true crime episode. I'm mostly going to be working from the book Murder in Cayuga County, but the movie does very closely follow that book, and I will point out some places where it doesn't. If you do plan on watching the movie, it might be interesting to know the backstories of some of these characters. I'll let you know when you're at the point of no return, and you definitely need to turn it off if you plan on watching the film. So, get comfortable. This is going to be a long one. This is Moving Through Georgia, and today, a murder in
Cayuga County.
John Wallace ruled Meriwether County. He considered it his kingdom and often referred to it as the kingdom. He was involved with moonshine and a few other illegal activities, as well as running the tenant farmers of the county. He was ruthless with anyone who crossed him and would eventually admit to killing four men just to, you know, maintain his power and control. He was part of the larger Strickland family, a family that had ruled the county for over a century. Wallace's uncle ran the operation for years with an iron fist until he was shot by a federal officer, and, you know, the head chair passed to John. By putting John in charge, the family was bypassing Strickland's actual son, Tom. Tom Strickland was another member of the family with a reputation for violence and criminal behavior, but the family didn't consider him to have the mental strength to run a crime organization. They feared he would fold under pressure. Wallace wasn't about fear. He was the kindest, most courteous bootlegger and killer you'd ever meet. He contributed to the church, tipped his hat to ladies in public, acted like a Christian gentleman. Maybe after the reign of terror the Stricklands had imposed on the county, Wallace was a relief, as long as he got his way. This made sense. Times had changed, and Meriwether County wasn't the Wild West anymore. Men returning from World War II were a lot harder to control than those that John Strickland had to deal with, and Wallace did have the means and the methods. In the end, though, everyone prospered. Everyone knew their place, and everything was just fine, as long as Wallace was kept happy. Enter Wilson Turner, a sharecropper with a wife and a child. Turner helped out with the liquor operation. He was always short of money. One day in 1948, he was discussing the liquor business with his boss, John Wallace. Wallace was considering holding back a shipment of alcohol because there were rumors of revenuers in the area. Wallace liked making money, but he was deathly afraid of getting caught. Turner complained about his financial problems and wheedled 20 gallons of whiskey from Wallace. Wallace figured if Turner got caught, it would teach him a lesson about being more cautious. Turner took the whiskey and, avoiding the G-men, delivered and sold it. He returned to Meriwether with a big smile and a pile of bills, which Wallace immediately demanded.
Hand it over, son.
They argued, and Wallace kicked Turner to the ground. Taking the money, he demanded that Turner leave the county immediately. He had not learned his place. This left Turner with problems. He left the land Wallace had leased him with a 100-acre crop near harvest, and he felt that Wallace owed him for the work he had put into it. To even the score, he and his brother-in-law stole two of Wallace's prize cows. They stashed one with a family member in Crawford County, and we'll get back to him later, and he hid the other one in Carrollton. The next day, Wallace realized that he had been robbed and alerted the police of three counties and the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. The cow in Carrollton was located fairly quickly, and when Turner came to collect it, the sheriff was waiting. He was arrested and locked in the Carrollton jail, mercifully away from the Merriweather jail, where he would be at the mercy of Wallace and his men. Well, not for long. Eventually, the sheriff of Merriweather County, Sheriff Collier, arrived to pick him up.
Wallace will kill me! Collier will let him! Please, God, come on, take me! Oh, Wallace will kill me!
Thank you, Sheriff.
As he was being dragged out, Turner screamed to everyone there that the men were going to kill him. But the cows had been stolen in their county, so it was their jurisdiction. After spending the night in jail, something strange happened. A trustee wandered into Turner's cell and told him that he had been given instructions to open the cell door at noon. The trustee had been told there wasn't enough evidence to hold Turner, and he was to be set free. Turner left and got in his car. Seeing Wallace leaning against his car in the town square, he realized that something was up, hit the gas, and ran. Wallace and a few others followed in their car. Turner led the chase for miles, finally crossing the county line and pulling over in a tourist camp parking lot. He burst out of his truck and ran to a restaurant, shouting that the men following him intended to kill him. A crowd gathered as Wallace's men grabbed Turner and tried to drag him into their car. When the people in the crowd said something, they were told Turner was an escaped prisoner, and they were returning him to jail. He held on, forcing Wallace to slam his shotgun down on Turner's head. He hit him so hard the gun went off. Then Turner's limp body was thrown into the car. Everyone jumped in, and they disappeared up the road. A few minutes later, the phone rang at the Cayuga County Sheriff's Office in Noonan. Lamar Potts answered it. Potts had been sheriff for 12 years and was known as a quick and fair lawman, one that you'd be crazy to go up against. His county had the lowest crime rate in the state, and he worked night and day to keep it that way. He, or his only deputy, who happened to be his brother, took the call and learned that a man may have been killed, or at least was abducted, in his county. Potts listened to the witnesses' stories, then called the sheriff of Merriweather County to ask if they had had a prison break. The sheriff said they hadn't. It wasn't hard to make a connection to Wallace. Wallace had recently reported Turner as the thief of two cows, and he did match the description given by the restaurant goers.
Lamar, John Wallace, he just about owns Merriweather County.
This ain't Merriweather.
Wallace and Sheriff Collier of Merriweather sat down and tried to get a hold of the situation. His best chance was ensuring that the body of Wilson Turner was never found. The old adage, no body, no murder, was really in force back then, and without a corpse, Wallace could walk scot-free. Wallace had a few more things on his side. The sheriff was basically a paid employee. No one would speak to another county's lawman against him, and, as I say, there was no body, but he needed some assurance. So Wallace traveled to Henry County to visit a friend, Amanda Mahaley Lancaster.
Good evening, Miss Mahaley.
Well, you went ahead and killed him, didn't you?
Who told you that?
I have seen the wicked spreading himself like a Green Bay tree.
Let's digress for a moment and talk about Amanda Mahaley Lancaster. She was born in 1875, supposedly with a caul, and any fan of Stephen King knows that babies born with the amniotic membrane covering their face like a veil are born with special psychic abilities. She apparently began telling fortunes at 6 years old, and this ability would bring her fame and a decent fortune, but boy, there's a lot more to her story. Physically, she was striking. She would sometimes wear expensive dresses and jewelry, and sometimes feed sacks and an old army hat. A book I used for this episode called The Oracle of the Ages says that when she was poor, she dressed rich, and dressed poor when she was rich. She was missing her left eye, for whatever reason, we don't know, and would sometimes leave it empty. She might wear an eye patch, or a false eye she painted herself, or an ordinary marble. She never married and lived with her sister Sally. She interacted with all parts of society, criminals, politicians, and lawyers. She would be somehow connected with two major court cases. In the movie, Andy Griffith's character consults with her often, asking advice and trying to read the future. She's played by June Carter Cash. One story in this book, The Oracle for the Ages, is about a family who went to consult Mahaley when one of the family had been reported missing after D-Day. Mahaley pronounced that the boy was alive and would contact the family by telephone in about 3 months. Sure enough, after a few months, the soldier checked in with his family from a hospital in Wales, where he had been unconscious. As her fame grew, she soon became a target for robbers. Rumors of her money being stuffed under mattresses brought out the worst in people, and she and her sister and mother would sometimes wake to see men rummaging through their cabin right in front of them. In the movie, she states that she had been robbed 22 times. That spate of robberies actually happened after the trial when she became more famous and more people came to consult with her. But eventually the sheriff of Henry County, where she lived, explained that the county couldn't afford to keep watch outside her house, so they escorted her to town and photographed her opening a bank account. She also practiced law, but nobody really knew if she had a license or not. This began when she appeared in court over a lawsuit with an insurance company. She simply arrived at the court on the day of the trial, announced that she was a lawyer, and pled her case. She was also known for loudly defending Leo Frank in person or in the newspapers and denounced the people of Marietta when he was lynched. She often wrote for the paper, urging local politicians to bring in factories and railroads. What else did she do? She ran for the Georgia Senate but lost. Some memorials after her death described her as a state legislator, but she wasn't. When she died, her estate was estimated at $200,000, and she had left behind quite a legacy. Back to our story. The night Wallace went to see her, he wanted to know if Wilson Turner's body would be found. In the book and movie, she tells him that the body will be found by one better than him, and she's obviously referring to Lamar Potts. Maybe she was psychic, or maybe that's just hearsay. But Potts was trying to put the story together. The people of Meriwether County were of no help, and a few dropped vague threats for the sheriff if he continued after Wallace. As Potts organized a search for the body, Wallace made sure it would never be found. Two African-American employees of his were called in, and the body was recovered from the well where it had been originally hidden and brought into the woods. The men made a pile of branches, placed the body on top, soaked the whole thing in moonshine, and burned Turner's body. The ashes were dumped in a nearby creek.
Hi, Sheriff Lamar Potts. Come get me now.
From the police work already done, Potts was able to swear out a warrant for Wallace and his friend Herring Savelle for kidnapping and murder. Searching Wallace's house, he found a set of clothes with dark bloodstains down the back, indicating that whoever had worn the clothes had been carrying a heavily bleeding body. Savelle also had a pistol in his car's glove box that still had blood on the barrel. Then, the real work began. Men were marshaled and sent into Meriwether County to find Wilson Turner's body. The ground and creeks were searched as Potts and another officer visited Mahaley Lancaster, who may have told the men that Wallace had hidden the body and given some vague references to fire and water. Very theatrical if it actually happened that way. The dominoes started to fall. There's a lot of detail, a lot, and you really should see the movie to keep it all straight. There's a lot of good police work done in this investigation. And soon, not only Wallace and Savelle were in jail, but also Sheriff Collier and Tom Strickland, the one who had been passed over to become head of the kingdom. And it turns out everyone was right about him. Under questioning, he folded faster than Superman on laundry day. Strickland gave it all up. The body was never found, but the two who burned the body were questioned and offered to testify in court that they had disposed of Turner. Some ashes and bone fragments were found in the stream, and some body parts were even found at the bottom of the well. Even better, a note written and signed by Wilson Turner was also found at the bottom of the well. I guess it had fallen out of his pocket. The evidence was piling up. Witnesses were turning over and agreeing to testify, and it looked like only a miracle could save John Wallace. If you plan on watching the movie, call it here. See the end, see the trial, and then come back to finish the episode. Okay, for people who have seen the movie or don't plan to, there's a detail here that wasn't in the film. It turned out that Wilson Turner was still alive. A newspaper article with the headline "Mystery in Noonan Gets More Mixed Up" says, "An officer of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation says the body of a man found in a shallow pit in Meriwether County was that of William Turner, who had been going under the name of Wilson Turner." William Turner had been drafted, but he had deserted, and he was hiding by using his brother Wilson's 4F draft card. In fact, he left one of the cows he stole in the care of his brother, the real Wilson Turner. Now, people charged with serious crimes will often latch on to small technicalities. A lot of Wallace's supporters thought he would walk after it was found out they were prosecuting him for killing a different man. No, a murder was still committed, a body was burned, and the trial went on.
Miss Mahaley, I notice you have a different hat on today.
Well, the other one's from World War I. Belonged to my brother. He got killed in action.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, that's all right. We still talk.
Mahaley Lancaster did testify for the state at Wallace's trial. She testified that Wallace had come to her to locate the lost cows. She told him where they could be found and described the truck they had been moved in. When she named Turner as the culprit, Wallace threatened to kill him. Later, he would consult her about Turner's body, asking if the sheriff had any chance of finding it. The newspapers made kind of a joke about putting a palm reader and psychic on the stand, and when Wallace's lawyer cross-examined her, he tried to subtly make her look like a kook. But whatever business she was in, she had heard Wallace threatened to kill a man. Wallace's lawyer's strategy to defend his client was to lead the witnesses into confusion and the judge into error. He would pull apart every witness statement until they were utterly confused, trying to make them look as if they were lying or dumb. After seeing the evidence presented for the prosecution, the two other men implicated in the murder took the fifth and refused to testify on Wallace's behalf. Wallace, however, would have a chance to speak. Under the law at the time, a defendant could simply make a statement to the jury. They could take as long as they wanted and wouldn't be asked any questions from either side. Wallace jumped at the chance, and this story he tells is a bit different from the one in the movie.
But then word came to me that Turner was making liquor on my land. Naturally, I was distressed. What if someone should think I was involved in this illegal trade?
He does say that Turner was involved in moonshine and that Wallace, an upright Christian businessman, was afraid that somehow he would be associated with such an illegal activity. Turner had also bought a car and was encouraging others to buy one as well. Wallace thought this was distracting to a working man and would only lead to their ruin. Of course, there was no legal way to remove Turner from the property he rented, so Wallace went to him and reprimanded him for his lazy and criminal ways. This infuriated Turner, and word soon spread that he was carrying a gun to shoot Wallace at the first opportunity. Then, suddenly, Turner just left town. This was 1947. A year later, Wallace would notice two cows missing, and Turner would be arrested for the theft. There wasn't much evidence, so Turner was released. Wallace went to the jail to talk to Turner, but seeing him drive off, Wallace went after him, intending only to discuss the thefts and help Turner back on the straight and narrow. He admitted to grabbing Turner and shoving him into his car, and admitted the shotgun he was carrying did go off accidentally. He claims he took Turner to the scene of the cattle theft to try to get a confession. There was an old well on the site, and, for some reason, Turner asked to be put in the well. I know this is getting long, but Wallace had talked for almost 7 hours, and he's building to his point. Turner asked to be put in the well for 2 or 3 hours, then he would help find the cows. Thinking it over, Wallace heard a noise and turned suddenly. That's when the shotgun in his hand went off and killed Turner. Oops. It was an accident, but an accident that had occurred in Meriwether County. If he died there, Lamar Potts had no jurisdiction, and the trial would have to be held in Meriwether. Now, this story might sound ridiculous to a Cayuga County jury, and it might sound ridiculous to you and me. But in the county that John Wallace basically considered his property, well, it might just work. That was it. No witnesses testified in Wallace's behalf. When Wallace asked his lawyer how his 7 hours of testimony went, he replied,
"John, you just buried yourself."
Nobody was buying the accident story, and the verdict came in guilty.
On the 30th day of July, between the hours of 10 a.m. and 2 p.m., you will be put to death by means of electrocution.
Appeals were filed, of course, and in the meantime, Wallace's people worked at selling everything he owned or transferring it to friends and relatives. Wallace was no longer the powerful ruler of the kingdom. He was a destitute man fighting for his life. Petitions were circulated to have the sentence commuted or a new trial scheduled. Wallace was basically unruffled through this. He had friends in high places and knew that his conviction hinged on the testimony of two black men. In 1949, the case reached the Georgia Supreme Court, and they confirmed the conviction. Wallace was moved to a jail in Atlanta when word got around that a breakout was being planned, and the case moved up to the United States Supreme Court, and denied. At the end, as Wallace was taken to Reidsville and the electric chair, he was still confident. Either he would be rescued during the trip or the governor would call and commute his sentence at the last minute. He even refused a last meal. What was the point? Until the switch was thrown, Wallace expected to be rescued somehow. He wasn't. Three of his associates were convicted and sentenced to life in prison, but they were paroled in the 50s. Sheriff Collier was to go to trial but died of a heart attack before it would begin.
We'll return after these messages.
I'm really excited to tell you that I have two live shows coming up. The first one is Saturday, April 6th. That's at BSG Cafe in Cornelia. That's a new place next to Big Daddy's. Next, on April 13th at Sweet Southern Creations on Washington Street in Clarksville. It's more or less across from the theater. Both will start at 3 o'clock. They'll last about an hour. No admission, of course, and both will lean a little more heavily on true crime than I've done in other live shows. The Cornelia show will focus mostly on Cornelia and the Clarksville show on Clarksville. If you've done a Haunted Habersham ghost tour with me, this is all new material. I'm not reusing any material from the ghost tours. And I'm really excited to get out and meet some people who are listening to the podcast. So if you can make it on April 6th or April 13th, I'd really love to see you there. Okay, wrapping up, and this has been a long episode. The movie came out in 1982. It was aired on television, and I think Johnny Cash and Andy Griffith really put in good performances on this. Johnny Cash might have just been playing himself, but he was good at it. Andy Griffith, however, as the bad guy, it takes a little while to get used to it, but he's actually pretty good at it. One thing that did surprise me was the movie's use of the N-word. Yeah, okay, I understand people in the South used to talk like that, so hearing it in a period piece doesn't really bother me, but hearing it in Andy Griffith's voice really does. To me personally, just the idea that Sheriff Andy Taylor, being sheriff of a town in North Carolina in 1952, probably used that word all the time, I don't know, just doesn't sit right with me. Also, and this is a minor detail, but I guess they shave people's heads for execution in the electric chair, and it is kind of unusual to see a bald Andy Griffith. And if any of you know any good movies that also have to do with Georgia history, and yes, I have seen Gone with the Wind, and that would be like a 3-hour episode, but if you know of any, movingthroughgeorgia@gmail.com. Hey, before we go, I mean, we've been going for 25 minutes, so what's another couple of minutes? Let's talk about Coweta or Coweta County. It was created in 1825. Now, the word Coweta or Coweta might be Creek for falls or place where there are falls, because apparently there are falls on the Chattahoochee River there. Georgia Place Names by Ken Krakow says that it was given this name to, quote, perpetuate the fame of the head chief of the Coweta Indians, General William McIntosh. We've heard all about McIntosh in a previous episode involving Governor Troup, so he was the leader of the Creek in Georgia who was considered a traitor and eventually murdered for selling his land to the state and moving out west. Meriwether County was not named after the fellow from the Lewis and Clark expedition. It was actually named after General David Meriwether of Virginia, who served under George Washington during the Revolution. Noonan, the county seat of Coweta County, was named for General David Noonan, from North Carolina, and served in the Indian Wars and the War of 1812. He eventually became a Georgia State Assemblyman. Oddly enough, there is another city called Noonan in Pike County named after the same fella. Meriwether's county seat is Greenville, named after Nathaniel Greene, who also gave his name to Greene County. We've talked about him a few times. And around the ring you go, a grand old right left walk on your heel and toe, promenade that pretty gal to Georgia. That's all.